Welcome to another very special episode of the podcast that I, Terry Wenham, call Tales from the Battlefields. And this week, I want to think about those underage lads that joined up in the Great War. And we're going to start by listening to the words spoken in old age by one of those young lads, Dick Trafford. He was just 16 when he lied about his age. And this is what he said.
Well, I didn't think anything about it, really speaking. We just took it in our stride, a young fella, all full of beans, you know, wanting to be a soldier and all this kind of business. He was one of the lads kind of thing. It never entered your head, really, to think about what the results was going to be.
Dick was to soon find out the harsh realities of trench warfare and the Western Front.
You could feel the bits of shrapnel dropping around you. The shrapnel shells didn't fire high up in the air. They burst as near as they could to the trenches, the top of the trenches, you see. But I always see the shells bursting, because you could feel them. You were just waiting for orders to go forward, to get over the top, wondering what was going to happen. You've got to feel like that's in a race. You're waiting to start off in a race, and you're just waiting for the off.
What an experience that must have been for these boy soldiers. As we now know, there were hundreds of thousands of young lads that were underage. They should have been 19 to fight outside of the UK to serve abroad. But so many of them lied about their age. And who better to tell the story of these boy soldiers than the author of the best-selling book, Boy Soldiers, Richard Van Emden. And I spoke to him this week from his home, and I learnt so much during our chat. And I hope you'll do the same as we listen to the stories of those boy soldiers from the Great War. I don't know whether you can see, but I've got the book here.
Yeah, it's the updated version that that's the old version. That's the 2012.
Is that how it was? Blimey.
Yeah, so that's, 2006 was when it first came out, then 2012 updated, then 2022, was it, that the latest version came out with all the new material in?
Is there
like
new
that.
Stories in that one? Right, okay.
Oh, God, 100, yes.
Yeah, oh, brilliant.
21, yes.
It's never ending, isn't it? It's never ending, because as soon as you think that you've, as soon as you think that you've finished, there's some more come up, isn't there, all the time?
Oh, yeah. I mean, a lot of people do send me information about individuals who are sort of 16, 17, but really there are so many of them. They're just legion that is actually only really the 13 and 14 year olds that I'm particularly interested in, because they're just, once you get above 14, once you get 15, 16, 17, it's just, there are so many. Absolutely extraordinary. The very fact that they served in the war age 16 is neither here nor there, because the real stories of the fascinating stuff is when you get down to the ages of 13. A handful of those, and then it becomes extraordinary.
I don't know about you, but can you remember, I'm 59. I mean, I think back to when I was 13. I was telling someone yesterday, I can remember my dad on my 13th birthday coming into the bedroom, kicking me out of bed and saying, "You're a teenager now, it's about time you started acting like one." You know, he was a soldier in the Second World War. But how on earth, when I think back to how I was at that age, or any age, but especially at that age, the only thing I would have done with soldiers is to play with my toy soldiers. Remember those little plastic soldiers we used to?
Yeah, yes.
That's the nearest I'd get to it. When I think of Sidney Lewis, you know, telling his story in Delville Wood, you know, they don't even look like boys, do they, at that age? They look like adolescents, don't they? They really do look like kids.
Yes. Oh, it's amazing. I mean, you see some of the photographs, and I mean, I saw one recently, actually, of a lad, and I was absolutely convinced he was no more than about 13 or 14. And it turned out he was something like 17 or 18.
Really?
Sometimes after all, just the way you put a lad in uniform, maybe.
I suppose so, yeah.
3 years to his age. Equally, I've got photographs in the book of, I think it's in your edition too, of a lad who looks like he's a child, and then 18 months later, he looks like he's an old man. Because the wear and tear of 18 months service at the front.
Yeah. Honestly, you know, I think this is what drives me on. And the time I mentioned that I'd met you once, and it was at, what do they call it, Historians Do Drink in London.
with
the Mad event, you know, with Peter Hart.
Yes.
And you sold me this book here. You had your stand.
Oh, right.
And I think this is my favourite series, these books here. I pick up this for my podcast and when I'm out on tour over and over again, not just the photographs, but the narratives in here. And I think you told me you got about 6,000 photos, didn't you, of these?
I've got nearly 10,000.
10,000?
Not a poisson, but 9,600, I think, now of soldiers' own photographs stretching the whole of the war period. Mostly, obviously, 1914-15 before photographs were banned. Yeah. Or cameras were banned, but increasingly I've got a really decent selection now from 17 and 18 as well. But I agree, I think of that series, 1916 was the best, because you see this incredible transition between the beautiful countryside of 1915 and the destruction by the end of the Somme.
Yeah,
we don't get in the same way in 1917. That felt more a more depressing book, because it just felt like with Arras and then Ypres and then Cambrai, so it just felt remorseless. Whereas 16, the Somme felt more hopeful in a funny sort of way.
The first time. Just this morning, I've been, I can see what you mean. Yeah, I was looking at these pictures early in the book. It just looked like unspoilt countryside with just like you can see the chalk in the distance, can't you, where the trenches are.
And it
looks like some of these photographs that look like Fricourt. I'm looking at this one at Fricourt here on page 55, and it looks like it does now if you stood there, doesn't it, in 1950?
Exactly. I've become almost as obsessed about the photographs as I have been about the whole story of boy soldiers. It's that and the Army of Occupation in Cologne. Those are my three fascinations from the Great War era.
I know what you mean about Cologne, because I went there last summer. We had a 3 days in Cologne, and all I did, my wife was, I drove her mad, was just walk around with all these original photos trying to line them up.
Well, I bought photographs for years and years and years of the occupation, and I lived in Cologne for a couple of years.
Did
and
you?
I interviewed a few locals as well, not as many as I should have done. I think it's the most fascinating period. You dump tens of thousands of men into a community. And see how they get on. And they got on surprisingly well. It's a fascinating story yet to really be written. Compared to the Great War, because I think I saw a TV program in 83, 84, probably 84, the 70th anniversary of the Battle of Mons. And I said to my mum, can you buy me a book, anything about it? And she bought me Goodbye to All That. And I got a book from that.
So that was it. Your mum bought you a book on Mons then. And you haven't got a family connection then with the First World War.
I only have a distant relation. I had a great uncle who served and he was, and funnily enough, he was, or sadly enough, he was killed in the bombing of Hull in the Second World War.
Right.
He served. But I have distant relatives on my German side and on my British side who served, but nobody directly, not my grandfather, great-grandfather.
No. So it was that book that got you interested, and then what took you down the route of talking about boy soldiers then and making that your passion, and you met a lot of them, you said, didn't you?
Yes, I mean, it's always I'm always on the lookout for new stories, for something that will sort of spark my interest. And I think I just became interested, like everybody, walking the battlefields. And cemetery after cemetery, I'd go, oh, look, there's a 16-year-old. Oh, there's a 17-year-old. Oh, and sort of looking it up and going, well, what's been written about that? And finding absolutely nothing. And I'm not don't mean a few pamphlets or, one small 100-page book. I mean, nothing had been written on the subject whatsoever. Mm. And I thought, wow, what an incredible story. But I didn't know at that point just how good it would be. I mean, I didn't know about all the political side as well, about Sir Arthur Markham, the Liberal MP, who they caused. So it was only when I went and had a look at Hansard to see if the subject had been even mentioned that I discovered that there were pages and pages, rafts of evidence given by MPs in Parliament about how many of these lads are joining up. So it was a story that just kept giving and giving. And when you realise that nobody else has done anything about it at all, it excites me, but also it was daunting, of course, because you can't go to source, you can't go to a book and go, okay, well, what are the parameters? What am I dealing with here? Mm. You know, there's so many, if I want to write a book about the Somme, I've got 1,000 books that will tell me all about it and give me some ideas. there was nothing for boy soldiers, and but that in itself was a, that was the spark. But I got interested in the story of boy soldiers probably around about 2000, I suppose, something like that, when I'd just seen enough graves on the Western Front to make me think there's something there. I was always amazed because I went over in 86 for the 70th anniversary of the Somme. And it didn't occur to me then, but I met a lot of veterans, probably about 25 to 30 at the time. And so many of them had been 15 or 16 or 17 during the battle. And I didn't really pick up on it then, but in retrospect, looking back, I kind of went, there were some great stories there. And that really, I think around about 2000, I started to kind of systematically collect material, starting putting stuff aside that I could use in a book.
But by then, of course, 2000, nearly all of them had gone, hadn't they? But you'd already spoken, you'd already interviewed a lot of them before that then, presumably.
A lot of them, it started off with a guy called Norman Ralph Skelton of the Royal Engineers, who I met on the Somme in 86. He was the first veteran I met who I also discovered had been underage. So it started then, but I can't say I had so many interviews with boy soldiers, because as you say, by 2003-04 they'd all gone anyway. We did make a program called Boy Soldiers of the Great War 4-4, and so we were able to interview the few last ones at that time. Dick Trafford, who was in King's Liverpool's, was one. He was good, and he'd been 15 during the Battle of Loos. So there was just the opportunity then to go back and really get some.
What was he like then, Dick Trafford? Because I've looked at those videos and I've read his accounts. What was he like? Was he happy to talk to you at this stage? Had he talked about it before? And could you just give us a summary of what his record was, what his experiences? You remember?
Yeah, I mean, he'd been a miner. He'd left school, become a miner, and like a lot of boy miners, hated it. You know, was quite fearful of what he was, the conditions he was working in. And he, when war broke out, he just followed a lot of territorials down to the recruitment office. And they obviously, like so many of these lads, they said, "You're too young." But he said, no, I'm 19. So they turned a blind eye, went to France with a battalion in 15, served on the Somme, served in the Battle of Loos, actually went over the top at Loos. Could easily have been killed then. He remembered one incident where a German in a trench was about to shoot him. The Germans counterattacked and a German was actually on top of the trench about to shoot Dick Trafford when somebody turned a machine gun on the German. So he had a pretty rough time at Loos, and then fought through the Somme, fought through Passchendaele, went right through to the end of the war. Extraordinary career, and went to the occupation as well, which was of course my other interest. So he was a great interviewee. He'd spoken about it before for sure, but he wasn't one of those veterans. There were a couple of veterans, like a man called Robbie Burns, who you really felt he talked it out. You know, you really felt when you interviewed him, he was just going through the motions, that he'd spoken about his stories before and you were just the next person to listen. Dick Trafford wasn't quite like that. I think he actually he enjoyed talking about that time, Robbie Burns less so. And so Dick came across as a more kind of authentic voice in many ways. Someone who respond to your questions, think about what you'd said, come back with something interesting. So he was a great interviewee. And of course, you know, being 15 was pretty extraordinary.
I know. As we said earlier, I keep thinking that every time I talk to you or read your books and see these ages on the headstones, I keep going back to when I was that age. And I thought, I couldn't have done it. I wouldn't have been.
Well, my son is 16, going on 17. And, you know, it's a funny thought, really, that up to this point, we're at the First World War, I'd be able to get him out of the army at 16. But in a month when he turns 17, he would be forced to remain in. And that's the kind of slightly funny feeling, really. That the army would now think that they could take him and take him to the battlefields, but I can't imagine my son serving at all. I really can't, but you know, there we go.
Different times, aren't they? And I suppose what we ought to mention then, as we're talking about this, is what the definition of a boy soldier. How would you define what a boy soldier was in terms of years?
Well, I mean, technically, obviously, being a boy soldier was a specific rank in the British Army, and you could enlist. Was it as young as? Oh gosh, I can't remember now. Was it as young as 12, or if your father was in the army already, you could.
Right,
you
could be allowed to do that, but not go abroad.
No, God, no. So Was it 12? Was it 14? Gosh, I'm now starting to question myself. But yeah, I mean, it was a specific rank which you held until you were 18 in the British Army. But of course, I'm talking about boy soldiers. So I'm literally manipulating the term slightly to talk about lads who were enlisting underage. So
yeah,
start of the war, the British Army says basically we want boys who are 19 or over. And anybody under that is considered by me to be underage and therefore part of my greater story.
Yeah.
So those two definitions, the definition of what is a boy soldier, the army rank, and then my term, which is boy soldier, which is about boy soldiers, which is about the kind of, you know, the underagers who enlisted in 1914 or primarily in 1915.
And when you talk about the likes of Dick, and another favourite of mine was Albert Marshall. I like his story. Is that the one they called Smiler? Do you call him
Smiler? That's right.
Yeah, Smiler. Why did they do it? Why did they decide to enlist? As I suppose they'd left work. They weren't at work. They left school. They were at work now, weren't they? So they were like adults in that respect. But why? I suppose there were all different reasons, were there?
Myriad reasons. I mean, I always remember one veteran saying he was working in an iron foundry and he found the machinery more terrifying than the Kaiser.
Really?
So he was quite happy to enlist. It's all about a sense of adventure, being with your mates. You know, everyone else is going in, why don't you?
Yeah.
Fear of being called a coward,
etc.
Patriotism thrown in. I mean, there's so many reasons why they would join up. But essentially, it was just a kind of ignorance of what war was going to be like. Wanting to do something a little bit different. And of course, they were recruited by people who, yes, yeah, so there was the incentive of being paid for recruiting these lads. But also a lot of these recruiting sergeants thought these lads will never go abroad. They'll never see action. The war will be over anyway. Why not give them, you know, a few months in the countryside, get them some fresh air.
Yeah.
A lot of these boys are weedy, underweight, you know, small chest sizes. Well, it will help build them up. So
3 square meals a day, wasn't it? I suppose that was the same for all of these working class lads. They were getting better paid, better fed and better clothed in the army than they would have been working as farm labourers or in the
Yeah, family. Exactly. 3 square meals a day. And, you know, you're going to get a lot fitter in 1915 in the British Army in the countryside than you will being down a mine. And
And how did how did that go through? I've heard some wonderful tales about how these young lads got through the enlistment process, but I suppose it wasn't very thorough. Is that the answer?
It was more thorough in 1914 than it was in 1915. Of course, in 1914, they had men queuing down the street and could afford to be a lot more picky if they wanted to be. Now, of course, there were the classic stories of, you know, go around the block and come out and tell me your 19 stories. And those were, you see those over and over and over again.
Mm.
Equally, they could afford to be more picky. More boys got kicked out within days of enlistment anyway. They'd get to the depot and they would say, you know, there's no way you're going to work here, right? Off you get and dismiss them. It's 1915 when the army's getting more desperate for soldiers, when the number of recruits is down at roughly less than half of what the army says it needs, that people start really turning a blind eye and allowing pretty much in. I mean, you cannot believe the physical sizes of some of the lads. All right. Yeah. When they get really, you know, when they're 4'10" with the chest size 28, you really, you know, they're not many. They're few and far between. But I have seen people of that height and that chest size getting into the British Army. And I've spoken to Taff Gillingham about it, you know, my great mate and a brilliant First World War historian. And he said, I just can't understand how they would even get a uniform on someone who's got a chest size of 28. You know, I don't...
Yeah, just
you know,
hang on. Just hang on.
Webbing and everything wouldn't work. So unless they're being specifically tailored for that lad, I don't know. But, I mean, you see some pretty decrepit people getting in 1915 just because they need them. They're desperate for men.
And then, I know this is an ever-moving target, but when we talk about the numbers... What's your latest estimate on the amount of boy soldiers that served on the Western Front and how many died? Do you have any accurate figures?
Well, I mean, if you're looking at the latest edition, which is the final edition, the 2021, the figures have exploded from roughly 250,000, which is a number I always felt I could back up, but was based on slightly looser stats. Well, I've had another 10 years to be able to work on those, and I've come up with a figure of 400,000 plus. I mean, I think 400,000 is actually remarkably a slightly conservative figure. I address that in the book. I say there are all sorts of things that I've left out that I could have included. I don't even include the cohort of 1918 at all, because, of course, for 6 months of that year, you could be 18 and a half and serve overseas. So if a boy's killed aged 18, unless I go into in-depth research on that individual, I can't tell you whether he's 18 and a half and serving overseas legitimately or 18 and 3 months and not. So I've sort of removed that as a class entirely. So so the figure still comes out at around 400,000.
And that's how many served on the Western Front?
That's how many served. I mean, somebody made a point on the Great War Forum, which I took a little bit of umbrage at. They said, oh, I've statistical research. Not many were killed at all. Know, it's 3% of all those who served and blah, 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 blah.
3%.
Or 0.3. I can't even remember what the figure was, but it was ridiculously low.
Right.
And I thought, well, all you've done is plug in 16, 17, maybe 18 into Commonwealth war graves and come up with a figure. That doesn't work like that.
Well, they won't have ages on them, most of them, will they?
Well, half of them don't, just over half, about 50, what is it, 52% don't have ages. So you could double whatever figure you come up with, you could safely double. But my point was that you can't look at it like that, because you could imagine there's a boy of 15, he enlists in 1914. He goes to France aged 16 in 1915. He serves at Loos, he serves on the Somme. He's then killed aged on the day after his 19th birthday in 1917. Now, the stats will tell you he's not a boy soldier. No, he died as a 19-year-old. But that would be so disingenuous, because he'd served 14, 15, 16, 2 years out in France, underage. The fact he's killed on the first day that he's 19, well, he shouldn't really be excluded entirely from the figures. So my point was that you could look at these figures again. You could look at how many boys, say, for example, you could look at 17-year-olds in 19-year-olds killed in 1917. And you could look at them as a class and you could say, right, OK, what percentage of those have 14, 15 stars? Well, of course, on the medal roll index, you can look at how many of them have got 14, 15 stars. And that will tell you automatically that they were serving overseas underage. The fact that they were killed on their 19th birthday or shortly afterwards doesn't really take away from the fact they'd been overseas for that length of time. So I did a lot of research into lads who were 19 in 1917, for example, or 20 in 1917, 21 in 1918, and going back and looking at what percentage had 14, 15 stars. And it was astonishing, and was able to then grow the figures from 250 to 400,000 just on the basis of that really detailed research.
But the only way you can do that is not take what that guy did, is not take some kind of theory, mathematical. The only way you can do that is to go through, like you did, go through every single soldier individually, isn't it? Manually.
Well, I mean, I can't do every single, there's just far too many. So you take a representative sample. So you go to the Commonwealth War Graves, you put 19 in as the age of death, you make sure it's just the army you're looking at, British army you're looking at. It comes up with a figure of whatever, 10, 12,000. You go, okay, well, I'll take 800 of those.
That's a big sample, then. It's a big sample, isn't it?
Big enough sample. So you do 8 lots of 100, and then you take them, you know, you maybe get rid of the bottom 100 and the highest 100, then they take an average of the other 600. So it comes out with a figure of, you know, 13.5% have got 14, 15 stars. And then
which is what you'd expect then, isn't it? That's the sort of percentage that you'd expect, because that represents the death rate, the national death rate, doesn't it?
So you can extrapolate from that very easily, and you can do that with each age. Even 22 in 1918, towards the back end of 1918, could have been an underage soldier in 14. I found one who was very unlucky. He was a lad who'd gone to France aged 17 in 1914, was killed about 2 weeks before the end of the war. When he was 21, 22, so he'd been all the way through just to be killed. He had originally gone over as underage in 1914.
Oh, blimey. You just can't imagine that, can you? You can't imagine going through all that, going in there as a boy, getting to be a man, war's nearly over, and he still doesn't get home.
And there are stories like that all over the place. And one of the things I was interested in doing was looking at how many lads were killed in 1918. Although, as I say, I didn't use them as a class in the end. But I found so many who'd either been discharged as underage in 1915 and 1916 and then come back in as, you know, when they were called up, or lads who just somehow muddled all the way through to die in 1918. And there are a lot of them. About 29,000 or something. Blimey. That I precluded from the figures that I could have included if I just taken 18 as an age.
Every one of those has got a story to tell, as you say, and you'd be forever writing books, wouldn't you, if you told every single story?
Oh, God. Well, this is it. You have to really just pick up on the really terrific stories, you can just extrapolate. I mean, there was one lad I found at Gallipoli in one of the Irish regiments, and he gets killed in an ambush when he joins the IRA after 1916, and killed. Yeah, it's a fascinating story. But he's in an ambush of some police officers, and he's the only casualty. And the police eventually dig up his body. They find where he's buried, and on it it's a plaque saying this is such and such killed in this ambush. And of course, you can go back, look at him. Yeah, he's on Gallipoli in 1915 with the Leinsters, I think, something like that.
Did he come back wounded from that then, from Gallipoli?
I'm not sure.
Sick, maybe. Wounded or sick, probably.
Yeah, he was discharged as underage anyway.
Yeah. So, I see. Right, and that's my next question. Is really, you touched on this earlier, but did the families, once they realised, try and get their boys back?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, a lot of the boys tried to be the architects of their own salvation. They would write to their parents saying, "Please, sweeties, you know, this is not what I expected. Really? I can't handle." Oh God. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've written two new chapters in the book, and one of the chapters is called "Our Winter of Discontent," and it's about the fact that the summer enlistments of 1915, when you get a real spike, generally over the summer holidays as well. So, you know, you leave school, you've got summer holidays ahead. You may be going back to school in September, but those 2 or 3 months you've got off. Encourage a lot of lads to go, "I'm going to join the army." So they go and join the army. The problem is summer enlistment, when it's nice and warm and you can stay out and sleep under the stars, turns into a winter deployment, and they absolutely suffer because they don't have the physical wherewithal to handle the condition. So they're training in, you know, July, August, September 1915.
Oh, 15, and
then they're sent out in after, you know, 4 months training, not a huge amount of time, and suddenly they're put into a trench and it's -4, and so they physically start breaking down. It's not just mentally, obviously, as well. But they're not being killed so much as they are just physically can't hack it. They can't carry the weights they're expected to carry. They can't deal with the cold and the conditions.
What you'd expect. And what did the parents do then? Was there a process that they went through? Did they go to their local MP, or did they go to the War Office? How did they, and did they manage to get some of the boys back?
Well, this is where Sir Arthur Markham comes to the fore, this Liberal MP. He picked up on the fact that, first of all, he's got a business where I think 20% of his employees have disappeared off to the army.
Okay.
And if you drive up the M1, you'll see, you know, Markham Vale. Well, that's his family. You know, they own coal, iron and steel industries, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And they've brought a great number of lads straight out of school. Well, these lads had enlisted. And so he was very annoyed at the fact that, you know, he lost 20% of his employees.
So he's got a vested interest, really, hasn't he?
Yeah. And he also started getting letters from soldiers saying, "We're not doing very much. We're sitting around. We're not being properly trained." This is back in the 1914. When the army's struggling with the numbers, and he thinks this is ridiculous. These lads could be, you know, could be digging coal or making iron and steel, which would be useful for the war effort. And yet, he's in the hut doing diddly squat. So he then gets onto it partly out of a kind of, you know, out of a business sense, but also increasingly you notice he takes it as a cause, as something that he actually thinks is morally indefensible. He says at one point, "Look, you know, if you really want to send 18-year-olds out there, you know, I don't really have a big problem with that. Even 17 and a half, I think he says, but you cannot send 15-year-olds out there. It just won't work." So he starts raising this in the Commons. It's then reported in the press. And then, so he becomes this kind of focus for parental anxieties about their young son who's about to go or has gone to France. And they start writing to him. So it's not just his constituents who are saying, "Please get my son out or help." It's also nationwide. So he has hundreds of letters a day, and he then, you know, he sees it as this great cause that he can follow. And he does that for a year, and sadly until he dies. But he has a big influence on the way that it's conducted in Parliament. So Parliament originally, you know, Harold Tennant, who's the Under Secretary of State for War, says we never knowingly take these boys underage. They've all lied. If they're there, it's because they've lied. Well, that was true, but they're still there nevertheless. And so they bought in this, well, if you send in your birth certificate, we will send it out to the Commander-in-Chief, and it's up to him whether he sends them back or not. Parental requests won't dictate whether anything will happen, but it will be viewed, you know, sympathetically. Yeah. So if you're 16, your parents send in your birth certificate, the likelihood is you will be sent home. And particularly if you as an individual is asked by your company sergeant or your platoon lieutenant, second lieutenant, do you want to go home? Yes, I definitely cannot stand it. Then the chances are almost certainly you would have been sent home. However, the individual could override, so they could say, no, I want to stay out here, which would override the parental request. And also the commanding officer, if he felt that you were important to his battalion. But that's so in 15, you start seeing a flow of boys back. Significant but not huge numbers, but it's only 1916, just before the Somme, that the rules change, where they say, okay, the birth certificate will be the sole arbiter in this case. You know, you will be, if you are under, if you are 18 and a half and over, you will be sent down to ETAP between 18 and a half and 19, ready to go back up the line when you're 19. If you're 17 to 18 and a half, you'll be removed to Britain. Fair enough, you know, but you will be kept in the army. If you're under 17, you'll be discharged. And that becomes the sole arbiter. But of course, the army could do that by then. The army, it was politically expedient to do it now, because you've got conscription, you're starting, you will very shortly get a flow of...
That's what I was thinking. I was wondering about how many of those men were maybe discharged or stayed in the army and then ended up going back under conscription anyway.
Some of them do. I mean, some of those that I discovered who died in 1918... are boys who have been discharged as underage in 1915, 16, and then are called back up in 17 because they've hit the age of 18, and they go out at 18 and a half or 19 and are killed. So you see quite a lot like that. But it becomes, am I being cynical saying that the army kind of realised that they don't need these boys anymore, whereas in 1915 they really did. And that's why they introduced that law, I don't know. But that change... means that during the Somme you see a real flow, especially after the 1st of July, when people understand what's happened, the disaster of that first day and the subsequent weeks when the casualties are high, even though progress is made on the battlefield. So you get a large number of boys going down to ETAP and then being sent back to the UK.
And I think what I've learned this morning, I've just been looking at the Accrington Powers on the 1st and looking at the newspapers there, and it's horrific. When you look at the newspapers after the 1st of July, and people looking at those newspaper reports in the build up to it, they genuinely thought that the big push, whenever it came, was going to be the end of the war. It was going to be the 14 to 16 war, didn't they? And then when all that went wrong, then they realised that it was going to go on forever. And it changed people's opinions, didn't it, of what was going on?
Yeah, I mean, up to that point, do we want to bring Johnny home? He's only 17, he's keen as mustard. We're about to get this big push that's going to end the war.
Yeah.
To stay out there after the 1st of July, when they see the casualty figures and they realise it's going to be for the long haul, then they say, no, they've had enough. And very often, as I say, the boys themselves, I looked at how many, the length of time, I took a sample of how long they stayed overseas, and not many of them stayed for more than a year.
Really?
As a proportion against, obviously anybody could be a casualty and end up going home or finding an early grave. But even so, they come back disproportionately high in as a class compared to other soldiers who are serving. So a lot of them manage 2-3 months, and then you get the sense they've broken down and they basically said, I can't do this anymore.
And that's understandable, isn't it? Because, their physical and mental well-being or growth wouldn't be the same as an 18, 19, 20-year-old lad. And we look at the shell shock and the effect it had on soldiers for the rest of their lives, but on boy soldiers that have come home, survived and come home, it must have affected them, mustn't it? Even more so for the rest of their lives. You must have seen that when you interviewed them.
Yeah, I mean, did it affect boy soldiers differently from other men? I mean, the trauma was there regardless.
It's the same, isn't it? The trauma's the same, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I never really got the impression. I mean, I met guys who said, look, you know, I abhorred it, I hated it, it was awful, but I would do it again. Or
really?
Or
they said that, did they?
For the world. Yeah, I mean, there was one lad, he went out age 17, he said, look, it tested me in every way.
Yeah.
But it set me up for life, you know.
Really?
And so, yeah, he said, you know, it made me realise, you know, that, I mean, I've heard this again from other soldiers as well, that, you know, there was a sense of, I've come back, I've survived, I really must make something of my life now. It gave me a kind of focus and impetus to do something rather than fritter my life away, because I've been given life where so many of my comrades have lost theirs.
Yeah.
But there were others who said, God, I wish I'd never gone. So, you know, you pick your soldier and you get your reply. It's changes
funny, isn't it?
so
Because, again, it's a myth, isn't it, that you think all of these soldiers think that their mates and brothers and that were murdered in some way, you know, by the generals and all the rest of it, all those myths, and that they hated it for the rest of their lives. And then you read so many stories of soldiers saying it was the best time of their lives. And this isn't survivor's guilt. This is the opposite, isn't it? This is, right, I've survived, I'm going to make the most of my life.
Yeah, and it's fair enough. I mean, there were, I mean, I remember Jack Davis, who was actually 19 when he went overseas, telling me, you know, I got there and I was depressed from the moment I arrived. He said,
really?
I realised I was either going to get killed or I was going to get wounded. Or if I didn't get either of those, I was going to have to sit here for years on end, and it was going to be really, really hard. So he said, all I did was suffer from Great Depression.
Yeah.
He said, you know, I got through it, and then I carried on with my life. And he didn't come across, or he never said to me that in any way that he was really profoundly affected. I even met one soldier, and I still find it incredible. I interviewed a guy who, he'd not been underage when he'd gone overseas, but I put an appeal out for veterans, and he wrote to me, and he said, I saw your appeal. He said, yes, I think I was in that lot. And I was like, you think you're in that lot?
How did you forget?
He said, my life has been so fulfilled. I've done so much of my life that I've really loved and enjoyed. He said, that war period, I've completely shut off. I remind myself if I'd actually been there.
Oh, that's incredible.
He was absolutely pucker. He'd been there in 1918, but he'd somehow managed to just basically block off or compartmentalize that his war service to the point where he said, I honestly can't remember anything.
And then he went to the Second World War as well. He must have done a course.
No, he didn't get second, but he went to the occupation. So I interviewed, he remembered more about the occupation. But either he had such a traumatic war that he was able to miraculously box it up and put it away and never think about it again.
Wow. That's mental strength, that is, isn't it?
Remember anything. I would tell you. He said, honestly, snippets, but nothing much. He said, I had to say, I've interviewed so many soldiers that come up with so many different stories about whether they wanted to go, whether they abhorred it. I mean, people like Harry Patch said he hated it. He never wanted to go. His brother went. He told him what it was going to be like. So he said, why would I want to go to that? I'm just a Somerset lad. I'm going to go and fight anybody. He hated it from the day he got there. And he said, and I was lucky because I was there in the summer, not in the winter. He said, God knows what it'd been like in the winter.
I've got this office that we had built at the bottom of the garden, which is great because I'm away from the house and everything. But we had bookshelves put in. I've run out of space, Richard.
You just suggested a book you're not going to read and put this one in, and it's in its place.
It's partly your fault, though. It's partly your fault I've run out of space. And Paul.
I meet so many people that say, I've got all your books. I'm thinking, well, why are my book sales even higher then? I don't know. When I go to a bookshop and I see a book on a shelf, I go, why isn't it sold? If it's not there, I think, why haven't they got a copy? So, I've never satisfied.
Well, it will never end, will it? It will never end. It'll be on sale and people will be buying them long after we've all gone, won't they?
Well, probably.
Right. So, we're talking about Markham, and that was an incredible what you were just saying about the guy that couldn't remember. He thought he was there but couldn't remember it.
Yeah, it was bizarre. He was so happy and so sort of just interested in life. He was like a composer or something, and he was fascinated not just by some Mozart but by the Beatles as well. He was just so he was 103. He was so sort of modern and so with it. I could almost believe that he was telling me the truth, that he genuinely was not interested in the war, and he put it away, and he'd not thought about it ever since. And I was the first person to mention it. As I say, I got more about the occupation from him than I did about the service. He wasn't there very long, but you wouldn't think you'd need to be there more than a week to have loads of stories. But there you go.
Yeah. Oh, wow. So the next one I wanted to ask you, yes, it hadn't occurred to me till recently. The first casualty, John Parr, alleged first casualty, was he a boy soldier then?
Well, he definitely under he's definitely 17.
Yeah.
He's killed. He's this some research now recently undertaken to show that he wasn't killed on the 21st of August
Yes.
after he was in fact killed on the 23rd. So I don't make a big deal of him in the in this latest edition because I think he even removed the paragraph when I mentioned him being the first casualty because he's
He
no
might
longer
not be. Yeah. He
almost
might not be.
not the first
Yeah, but he
casualty.
was definitely
Albeit,
underage.
but
Yeah.
yeah, he's 17 when he goes out there.
So, for the last 2 or 3 years since I discovered the story about Sidney Lewis, I've been wandering around Delville Wood showing his photo and telling his story. Is he the youngest, do you think, then?
Yeah,
He
without well,
is.
you know, the youngest that we know of. I mean, I found at the back of the book of the Boy Soldiers, I've got these unique lists of underage lads. So to make the list, you have to be 14 or under.
Yeah.
I've got, I can't remember what it is, about 80 lads who are aged 14 or under, something or 70. I've subsequently found about another 8 or 9 on top of that. But Sidney Lewis is the youngest by a country mile. So he
Yeah.
is about 13 and 2 months when he goes overseas. The next youngest is 13 and 10 months. So there's a huge gap. So it's possible there could be somebody who was younger.
We don't know,
We
do
may
we? We don't know.
know.
So when Sydney's joined up then, he must have only been, when he went along to the recruitment office, he must have only been 12.
He was 12, yeah. He was 12. He went in August 15 and he was born in April of 03. So he was 12 and what, 3 months or something?
But
Four months.
when you do look at his picture, he looks 12. He does look young. I know he's got his uniform on, so it makes him look old. But when you look at his face, he looks like a young boy, doesn't he?
He does. I mean, when you get down to 13, 14-year-olds, I cannot believe, except in exceptional circumstances, that they couldn't tell that they
Yeah.
were underage. You know, just the development, the physical development, the jawline, everything else would tell them that they were that. In his case, that he was 12 years old. I mean, how? And then you do see on files, medical officers saying, "I want to know how the hell this person, this lad, was ever taken in."
Yeah.
There was a bit of disquiet about some of the recruiting practices. But yeah, Sidney Lewis is 13. There's an ad, next lad is 13 and 10 months, and one who I found who was in the artillery who was 13 and 360 days. So when he went overseas, so he just crept in.
Yeah.
But what you see is you've got 3 13-year-olds that I found. It means almost certainly there were a
There's got to be
small
more.
handful. 14, I've got, 80, 90, whatever. We're talking in the low hundreds. As soon as you get to 15, it
Yeah,
explodes.
yeah, yeah,
I mean, I
yeah.
didn't even bother counting 15-year-olds. I wish I had, because it would have been interesting to see the proportion of 15-year-olds against 14-year-olds. But I found so many, I didn't bother making a
Have to do
note of
another
them.
book. You'll have to do another volume.
Well, what I want to do is the underage officers, and I think a lot went overseas in the early 15 when the officer casualties were so high. I think that's an unexplored story of how many 16, 17-year officers went to France in between, say, January and May of 15. So that's something which I may, in my
Yeah,
retirement, go have a
give an
look at.
aspect, isn't it? Like,
But I found a lot of underage officers.
there's a cemetery called the Bucquoy Road Cemetery on the road down from Arras down to the Somme, and I was wandering around there, and there was a second lieutenant, I forget his name now, and it said he was 17, and I thought, well, that was unusual. Anyway, when I looked at it when I got back home, it was a mistake. He was actually 27. So that, and again, that took me, then it made me start thinking, like you, how many of these became officers? But quite a lot of them, by the sound of it.
But again, I've got a list at the back of the book of the youngest officers that I found. And I think I can't remember what the number is. It's about
So they were
20.
commissioned in the field then, these men, these boys.
No, necessarily no, commissioned and sent out to France. So just
Blimey.
looking at the list now, it runs to, well, I've got 25 where I've gone into details about who they are. And then I've got an additional 33 where I just literally list them. So what's that? 58, and I found a couple since then. So, but the youngest, I mean, 16-year-old officers commissioned in the UK, sent out to France. Yeah, I mean, it seems extraordinary that
It does
they
when you
would take
think
part.
about when they actually get there as well. They're commanding what would be a second lieutenant in charge of a company
There's
commander.
two. Platoon commander, yeah.
Platoon commander. So they've got 30 or 40 men that are probably double their age that they're ordering around.
Yeah, well, the best is a guy called Battersby, who's a second lieutenant in the Accrington Pals. And he goes over the top on the 1st of July with his platoon, and he gets shot in the leg and subsequently has his leg amputated, but survives. And he's 16 years old when he's commanding on
What was
that
his name
first
again?
Battersby.
Battersby. Right.
He's in the book. There's a photograph of him in the book.
Brilliant. So I'm just doing, I'm going to do a podcast next month about the Accrington Pals. Just by chance, I just started to go through the newspaper archives and started looking at pages and pages of their obituaries there, and it made me think. So I've got some people coming over from Australia who want to go to the Sheffield Memorial Park. So I thought, while we're there, let's tell their story while we're there. There's no better way of doing it, is there, than
Yeah.
that?
Well, Bass photograph and details are in there. He wanted
Brilliant.
to join up as another rank, and his father, who was some high up in Manchester, I forget exactly his position, said, "No son of mine is going to go as another rank. You know, if you're going to go, you go as an officer." And
Really?
so he leans on somebody and gets him in the into the Accrington Pals.
So he wasn't from Accrington then. He was from
No, he wasn't from Accrington, he was from
no.
Manchester.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Right.
but all in the book, yeah.
Yeah. Blimey. So what do you think their legacy is then, these boys? Do they have a different legacy to all the other soldiers? I don't suppose they do they really?
Really? I mean, it's an incredible story. It's one which I was astonished had never been looked at. Apparently, Rose Coombs said this is a story that needs to be written. Her sister told me, Grace Alcott told me that her sister had said this is a story that needs to be written, and nobody has. So it's a brilliant, it is a most incredible story of fortitude, of endeavor, of courage, everything that you would say about any soldier
Any
who
of
puts
them,
foot in
yeah.
that war. So there's no legacy per se, other than the fact that it might be advisable not to take 250,000 or 400,000 lads into the army, 400,000 plus, and take a high proportion of those overseas. It might be better just to leave them at home. But we did it in the Falklands, didn't we? I think a couple of 17-year-olds died at Goose Green, didn't they? I think
And what about the
one
Second
or
World War?
his
Did
birthday.
the same thing happen in
It
the
did
Sixth
happen in the Second
Generation
World
later?
War. Again, nothing like the same number, but yeah, I mean, I've come across 16-year-olds serving after D-Day and things like that. So
Yeah.
they were nothing like the same number as
No.
the First War.
No, well, we've never had an army that big, have we? Before or
No.
since. So bound to be the case. So what projects? Obviously you've got the second edition came out, what, 3 years ago of this book. What are you working
Yeah.
on now then, Richard? You're always up to something.
I'm just starting a book looking more at the sort of legacy of that era. I've got a lot of interviews with children and relatives of those who served, which I'm going back through now, thinking about the legacy, and also wanting to do a book about the occupation, which is something I've been passionate about. And again,
Cologne,
I'm
yeah.
yeah that may be 3 or 4 years down the line yet, but I've got so much. I interviewed maybe 60 or 70 soldiers who were there with the occupation, and probably about 20 civilians who in Cologne who remembered that time. So I've got a really good archive of stuff, plus
Oh,
photographs, like that. So
well, look
yeah,
forward to that.
I think 7 or 8 books in mind that I want to write. And I just kind of every time I think of an idea, I put a file up on my Mac, and I just sort of anything that I find I chuck in there,
Yeah.
and then at the point when I decide I'm going to write the book, I go, right, what is it? What do I actually have? Let's have a look at all this
So
and
you're not writing all the
make
time then?
it.
You're not, it's not like a full-time every day.
It was a full time. I'm 58. I'm sort of not in retirement or anything like that, but I'm aware of the fact. I did think about, do I go on to the Second World War, and I decided
Yeah.
not to. So I'm sort of, the First World War is obviously a shrinking market in some respects. So and I've decided that I used to do a book a year,
Yeah, it's a lot of
which
work,
was
isn't it?
a lot of work, and now I'm sort of a book every other year. So
Yeah.
I'll carry on writing. But it's not full time because I'm too lazy for it to be full time, so I'll potter off and see friends now, which perhaps I wouldn't have done 5 years ago. I'm going to have a round of golf or something. So I love the Great War. I'll never go away from it now. I've realized that this is my kind of life's work.
Yeah.
But yeah, just the pressure to write is I've taken it off myself, and
Yeah. You
but
can
I
enjoy
still,
life, can't you? Enjoy life
yeah.
more.
And I
Yeah.
want to do more than, I mean, I've got all these photographs. I want to do some more books using those original soldiers' images. I mean, I'm spending a lot of money on it, so
Yeah.
at some point I would like to I'd
Do
like to
something
do
with them, yeah.
some more books on that.
Yeah.
I mean, I've got some incredible. I mean, I've got pictures of, of L Battery coming back from the Western Front on, being transferred, still in France, but the guns that smashed up at Neary and on the backs of train wagons coming back, you can see the all smashed, the guns smashed up. Original soldiers' photographs that taken of that battery, which is iconic.
Yeah.
Never seen images, so those
Yeah,
sort of
yeah.
images that I'd like to use in a book at some point.
I think this is what drove me, because I'm the opposite to you, although I'm a year older than you. I've spent like 40 years in the corporate world, knowing that I wanted to do something like this, not just this, but other volunteering stuff when my career ended. And COVID finished me off in the corporate world. And then since then, I started guiding for Paul Reed and doing podcasts and working for the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. So it all feels it feels very new to me doing doing podcasts, like, because I'm learning more and more and more every time I do some of my own writing or do a tour. Everything, every day is like Paul says, every day is a new learning day, isn't it? You learn so much from it.
Well, I'm the newspaper archive looking at stories, and I was looking at a chap called Boughton, who's run the BC and sort of came a cropper, really. He became an alcoholic, and I was trying to look up what it said about him in the newspapers at the time, and I've come across an amazing murder suicide story around at the same time, which I've never heard of before, but which is absolutely fascinating. And I'm thinking, God, what
You've
does
got to
that
tell
probably?
that story then, haven't you? You've got to tell that. You've got to get that story out there. You've got to,
Well, I come across this now, and I spent virtually the whole of the day going through hundreds of newspapers online, looking for all the material, all the stories, all the little nitbits that you one paper will have but another won't, to try and put the story together. And that really excites me. I'm just so glad I had the time to do it and the wherewithal to do it, really.
Otherwise, it would just take up. Once you start, you can't stop then, can you? Once you start.
I don't know how many books I'll write in the end, but we'll
You've
see.
still got
But
that enthusiasm though, haven't you? You've still got that enthusiasm, although it's been a job to
oh,
you, you've still got, it's still that passion is still there, isn't it? You can hear
oh,
it in
the
your
times
voice.
I've been to National Archives where I wanted to jump up and tell the whole room that I've just discovered the first British casualty of the Great War. I'm not talking about Private Barr. I'm talking about the first person who died, the British person to die in the Great War, which happened to be on the 5th of August, 1914. When I discovered something like that, or the officer who asked the Kaiser to go home and see his dying mother, but he promises he'll come back to his POW camp. When I discovered that story,
Yeah.
you just want to kind of jump up and go, "Oh my God, look, I know you're all looking at other stuff. Forget this guy." I love it. Like a childish enthusiasm, which I will never.
Don't think we'll ever lose that, will we? Because if we do, there has been times that I've been coming back from the battlefields exhausted, on a coach or something. Or sometimes people can be difficult. Some of the customers on coaches can be difficult. What am I doing this for? I'm retired. But then as soon as you get home, you just start looking forward to the next project then, don't you?
I mean, there were aspects of the Great War which I'm kind of not tired of, but well, in a sense, tired of. I'm sick of the violence. I mean, I remember Richard Holmes apparently saying after he wrote, what was the book, Soldier something? Anyway, his book on the his huge book on the Great War. That he really got disturbed by the level of violence he kept reading over, and he almost had a kind of PTSD. And I feel that's I'm not interested in hearing about somebody bayoneting somebody else for the umpteenth time. There are thousands of stories like that. You just go
Differently,
over and over, and actually, which is why I'm more interested in the sort of social aspects of, like the book I wrote, Meeting the Enemy, about what it's like to meet the enemy, not in war, but in every fact of life. Where two close countries are thrown together in a war, and so there are
And the
all sorts of
countries are
aspects.
the same, aren't we? Our culture and history, and it's not like fighting ISIS, is it? They're our cousins, German people, and they're so nice.
My grandmother was German, and he could have married Ernst Jünger, who absolutely adored her when they were at Leipzig University together, and I could have been a German Just as easy as I'd be, I'm a Brit.
Right, well, I'm going to let you go then. I'm sure you've got lots to do.
Actually, my legacy, Great War.
The other one, perhaps in a few months' time, I'd like to do, we mentioned today, is Harry Patch.
Yes.
We could talk about, maybe we could do that in September, which is be the anniversary, wouldn't it, of when he went, was it September the 22nd or something like that?
Well, the day he said he lost his mates, but we think he got confused with dates on that because it doesn't really work.
That, wasn't it? Was it August?
He was over the top on the 16th of August at Pilgrim Ridge.
Yeah.
That's a better date to go. Well, there's no more accurately placed memorial in the whole of the Western Front. You know, he said, we went over on a little pontoon on the corner and this memorial's like 2 metres to the left of that corner. Right. So
it's
incredible.
It is, isn't it? And people are always surprised. They think, when I pull in, they think, well, why are we going down this track in this lay-by? Yeah. You know, what are we going to see that factory over there for? You know, and then suddenly they get out the car and they see that.
Well, that's still the book that sells. All my other books, you know, Meeting the Enemy, Booking the out of print, and all they sell now as a download. Harry Patch is the only book that continues. I mean, not tiny numbers compared to what they were, but... Yeah. If you give Boy Soldiers the new edition a really good plug.
We will do, yes. Yeah, available from all good bookshops, Amazon, everything else, isn't it?
Yeah. It's my best. My mother always said Quick and the Dead was my best book.
Yeah.
But for this update, I think Boy Soldiers will always be my best book in terms of just the sheer research and
the work. Yeah.
The work, unbelievable. And now the material in there is just the new chapters have added so much.
Yeah.
Really
Brilliant. Oh, no, I really enjoy this. I've learned so much again. It's great to talk about all these other things as well, Richard.
Yeah. I'm surprised, if not before.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
All right, no problem.
Take care.
Cheers, you too. Bye-bye.
So there you go. As you can see, we started talking about Boy Soldiers and then went on to Harry Patch and all these other World War I stories, which no doubt will lead to more podcasts as we go forward. Hope you enjoyed that. We mentioned Richard's... Boy Soldiers book, and the second edition you can get, as we said, there on Amazon and from various retail outlets. And I'll put a link to that on the podcast page on my website, terrystours.co.uk. And also we touched on the documentary, it was probably about 20 years ago now, that Richard was involved with, and I'll put a link to that as well. You can still see that on YouTube, and you can listen to the words of people like Dick Trafford yourself. It really is an extraordinary story. And just finally, when we talk about Boy Soldiers or we go to the Somme, inevitably people go to the Sayre Road number 1 cemetery. They walk up the hill there into plot number 1, I think it is, and they go and find the story of Horace Isles, the Bradford pal that died on the first day of the Somme, and they read the letter that was written by his sister, Florrie. And this letter, I'm going to play in a minute, epitomises really what the families must have felt about their young boys going abroad, and with the Great Push coming along, they knew it was happening. And Florrie had exchanged lots of letters with Horace, and this letter never did reach him, because by the time it arrived on the Western Front, Horace had been killed. But just listen to the emotions that Florrie writes in that letter to Horace. And the letter is read by the actress Maxine Peake.
My dear Horace, just a line or two to thank you very much for the card Mother gave me yesterday. It is very pretty. I am so glad you're all right so far. But I need not tell you what an anxious time I'm having on your account. You have dropped in for the thick of it and no mistake. I only hope you have the good luck to come back safely like your father did. And my dear boy, I don't care how soon. I shall be more than pleased to see you, I can tell you. You have no need to feel ashamed that you joined the pals now. By all accounts, they have rendered a good account of themselves. No one calls them the Featherbed Soldiers now. We did hear they were fetching all back from France under 19. For goodness sake, Horace, Tell them how old you are. I'm sure they will send you back if they know you are only 16. You have seen quite enough now. Just chuck it up and try to get back. You won't fare no worse for it. If you don't do it now, you will come back in bits. And we want the whole of you. I don't suppose you can do any letter writing now. But just remember, I am always thinking of you and hoping for your safe return. So no more this time, only my love. Bob says hurry up and come back. Your loving sister, Florrie. 20 kisses. Several weeks later, this letter was returned to Florrie, stamped, killed in action.
So to finish with this week, I want to take a passage from Richard's book, Boy Soldiers of the Great War. And he talks about one of those young officers, a second lieutenant, Harold Cottrell. He came from Edgbaston in Birmingham and he'd applied for a commission, a temporary commission, as they called them, in October 1915. And it was just 2 months after his 17th birthday. And then in September 1916, he was given the order to proceed abroad and he took with him his dead brother's revolver. And he joined one of the old regular battalions, the 2nd South Lancs. And his parents were surprised because he'd gone to France, because they believed from statements made in the House of Commons that boys under 19 would not be sent abroad. Yet from the letters that Harold sent to his parents, he was only too keen to get involved. And just a couple of days after stepping foot on French soil, he wrote this letter to his father. He said, "My dear father, you will see that I've gone up into the line at last, and I'm glad to say I've managed to get my own battalion. I'm afraid I'm not allowed to give away my position, but I'm not 100 miles away from that place that we've just captured. In fact, I'm in the middle of the Somme battle. We are present in camp in a wood just behind the line, with occasional hymns of hate coming across from Fritz. The noise is terrific and the sky is lit up, with flashes of shells and guns mostly outside, and I expect it's pretty awful for the Hun. How they stand it, I cannot make out. All the prisoners I've seen have been big, fine men and were well set up. We are going into our trenches in a day or two now, and I expect we shall be in the next big push. However, don't worry, as it's quite a simple thing now. With best love, ever your loving son, Harold." And then 2 days later, he wrote to his mother in a separate letter. He said, "Just a line to let you know I'm going into action, so I shall not be able to write for a few days. We're going to take a certain bit of Hun trench, but as they've had a terrible artillery strafing for the last 2 days, I don't suppose it'll be very difficult. We've got the Canadians attacking on our right, and as they bear no love for Fritz, we shall be in good company. We are doing this show because this battalion failed in one of the former attacks on Tietvel, so everyone is keen to wipe out this score, and I can tell you this time there'll be no prisoners, certainly not on the part, because I have Freddy, his nickname for his dead brother, to think of. We're quite close to Tietvel at present, and luckily the Hun gunners have not discovered us. We came out here yesterday in the pouring rain and it was not at all pleasant, but I'm glad to say it is nice and fine now and I hope it keeps nice for the attack, to which I'm looking forward. The guns are fairly going at it now and it's very soothing to think of the state of the Hun at the other end. Best love, your ever loving son, Harold." And then they left their billet at noon to march up to the support trenches. They didn't go into action in the first wave. The attack was made by the Canadians. The Germans brought their artillery fire down in the trenches that were being held by the 2nd Lancs. There were a number of casualties sustained. 14 other ranks were killed, 80 more wounded. There was just one officer killed, and it was Harold. Now, Harold does have a grave. He's buried in the Poisier British Cemetery in plot 2, row F, grave number 22. And his parents chose this personal inscription for his grave. It says, "As a sacrifice, glad to be offered, a boy, he died for England." So all it remains for me to do is to say thank you for tuning in to the podcast this week. There'll be another one along next week. And as usual, we end the podcast by playing the last post in memory of all those boy soldiers that gave up their young lives on the Western Front and beyond in the Great War.